Well, good morning. The time is now 10 o'clock. Time for this hearing to begin. This is the second issue-specific hearing for the application made by DS Smith Paper Limited for an order granting development consent for the Kemsley Mill K4 Combined Heat and Power Generation Station. The application comprises the decommissioning of an existing gas-fired combined heat and power plant known as K1 and the construction, operation and maintenance of a new gas-fired combined cycle generating station, referred to as K4, with a nominal power output of 68 to 73 megawatts, on land at Kemsley, Sittingbourne, Kent, ME10 2TD. Thank you for attending. My name is Kevin Gleeson. I was appointed by the Secretary of State to be the examining authority for this application, and I'll be reporting to the Secretary of State for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy with a recommendation as to whether the development consent order should be made. I'm also joined by Ms. Eva Sherman from the Planning Inspectorate, who is the case officer for this proposal and is sitting at the table at the back of the room. Firstly, a few preliminary matters. Can everyone please switch off mobile phones or set them to silent? Can everyone hear me? Yes, thank you. I'm not aware of any fire alarm tests today, so in the event of a fire alarm, please exit via the doors either at the back of the room or behind me and congregate in the car park. And toilets are located past the lifts beyond the reception desk if anyone needs them. Is there anyone here from the press? No? Thank you. As with the other events, an audio recording of today's meeting will be available on the Kemsley K4 website as soon as possible after this hearing. With this in mind, there are microphones on the tables, which are operated by pressing the button, and it'd be helpful if you could state your name and who you represent, speak clearly into the microphones. Does anyone wish to film or record the event? No, thank you. Depending on progress this morning, I'll identify that we may have a break at approximately 11:15 for 10-15 minutes, and then continue. If we need to go on to this afternoon, we'll probably have a lunch break at 1 o'clock, but clearly that depends on progress. So I'm now going to ask people who wish to participate in this hearing to introduce themselves. If you're here only as an observer, there's no need to introduce yourself, but please complete the attendance list. And don't forget to state your name, who you represent, and speak clearly into the microphone. Firstly, from the applicant's side, I have been provided with a list of the applicant's team who are attending. Are there any changes to that list? Otherwise, I don't think I need to go through everyone's name, but we'll ask people to identify themselves when they speak.
Julian Boswell, solicitor with Burgess Salmon, representing the applicant. No, there's no change to the team.
Thank you, that's very helpful. Are there any other representatives from interested parties who wish to speak today? No? Okay. I had invited Swale Borough Council and Natural England to attend the hearing. I haven't heard from Swale, but Natural England have provided a written response to the questions, which is available on the project website, and I'll come back to those questions as we go through the main agenda. But hopefully people have seen that response and a similar one from the Environment Agency as well. So the notification for this issue-specific hearing into environmental matters was published on the project website on 5th of September, and it'd be useful for people to have a copy of that to hand, if possible, but it is also on the screen being projected. Are there any questions of an introductory or preliminary nature before we move on to the second item on the agenda? No? Okay, thank you. So item two is the examining authority's table of issues and questions for issue-specific hearing two. I'm going to go through and review the issues raised in the table which was attached to the agenda. Clearly, I'll be seeking responses primarily from the applicant on all questions, but if anyone else in attendance wishes to speak in relation to the matters arising from the table, they may put oral submissions to the hearing, and at that point the applicant will be provided with a right of reply. What I will say about the table of questions at this point is that question 2-7, which deals is the first question under the heading air quality, I'm intending to address that matter at the end of the table. That's an issue that is more likely to involve an exchange of a range of questions, be far more wide-ranging than some of the others. So I think it's better we put that to one side, and there will probably be quite a number of follow-up questions on that topic anyway. So otherwise, we will work our way through the table, and as I say, if anyone has anything they wish to say, please indicate, and I will try and bring you in as appropriate. So the first question was actually to Swaleborough Council, as they hadn't responded to any of the written questions at EXQ1. Clearly the Council aren't here, they're not able to answer that question at this point. I will be taking that up with them in the review of issues and actions arising, and hope that they will be able to respond formally to those initial set of questions. But if there are any ongoing discussions between the applicant and the council which could push that along, that would also be helpful. That's okay? Yep.
Yes, so we are in regular contact with Soil, so we'll endeavour to assist.
Okay, thank you. So the second question is in relation to the applicant's response to Q1.1.8, and it's there on the screen, so there's no need for me to read that out. My understanding is that the 75-metre height, which was referenced in Rep 2030, was an error, in that the proposal is for 70-metre minimum height, and also that the LVIA assumes a 70-metre height. What I'd like to understand is what would happen if the height were greater, and what its effects would be in relation to the ES, but also if the applicant could answer the general question there, please.
So, Sir Julian Boswell, on behalf of the applicant, just to give you an update on the process, as you know, we've explained that we were running a procurement exercise, and that part of that exercise involves a choice in relation to the boiler design, and whichever, there's two choices, and whichever way it goes affects the location of the stack. And we've put in two versions of the works plans showing different locations to reflect that. And we said in our earlier submission that we expected to have made that decision by the end of September, and we're still on track in that respect. So that decision is expected to be taken on the 25th of September, and we've got a pretty high degree of confidence that will happen, without boring you with the detail of the process that's underway. And so when we have that outcome by the end of the 25th of September, that then enables a number of, or sort of unlocks a number of things that can then be resolved that have necessarily been waiting for that decision. So one aspect of that will be a final position on some expected to be minimal flexibility on the height, which is the point you've just raised. The 75 metres was a mistake, that was a typo, so everything's been based on a minimum 70 metre. What we will be able to do is to give, so what we're working towards is a submission which we will be ticking a number of boxes. One of those is obviously to explain the decision, to explain that we're, which way we're jumping, as it were, therefore which works plan we are withdrawing and which one we're confirming. in addition to that, we will say what flexibility we're looking for, but I would stress it's expected to be small, and we will explain why we don't think it alters any of the conclusions of the ES, which we think will be straightforward to demonstrate in all the relevant topic areas. So that's not expected to be a substantial submission. Would it help if I go through the other areas that we think that decision kind of unlocks and enables things to be tidied up?
Yes, please.
So I know we're probably going to go over some of these later, but it might just help to have an overview. So I think it's in terms of the habitats matrices, the finalisation of those and agreement of those with Natural England has been awaiting the decision, because it has some differences whichever way you go. So we are, that is clearly understood with Natural England, and we're confident that when that decision has been made, and we've already have advanced information that is being worked on to try to smooth the passage of this and speed it through, that we will be able to explain the position, which way we're jumping to them, and resolve the final detail in the footnotes to the matrices. And then that's the final point, I believe, that needs resolution for the Statement of Common Ground, so that then when we submit that to you, you will have the confidence that you've got agreed matrices, which obviously, and footnotes, which are essentially are the Rees, aren't they? So at that point, we will have finalised those matrices and footnotes. We'll be able to submit the Statement of Common Ground to you. And as I've already indicated, we can make the decision on which works plan we want, and the final sort of the table in the DCO that specifies the minimum and maximum. We'll be able to put forward our final position in relation to that. Just as one tweak on that, sir, we think it would be prudent, for certainty, for everybody's benefit going forward, if the two stack heights are expressed by reference to AOD, above ordnance datum, just so that there's no potential for confusion. We think those are the two aspects of that table that it is prudent to fix by reference to AOD, because obviously reliance is being placed on those stack heights for that purpose. And so for that reason, we have a topographical survey, an up-to-date topographical survey that shows the AOD levels, and we will include a suitable extract from that and an explanation so that you can see how the number has been calculated. But yes, the stack element will be on the basis that that we've been proceeding so far. So I think that's my sort of headline answer to your question.
Thank you, that's helpful. Can I just come back on a couple of things from that? In your response to Q1.1.8, which is Rep 2030, it was said there that the tendering process currently scheduled to be completed by the end of August. Has there been a change, or is the tendering slightly separate from making the decision? Or would that be the discrepancy between August and September?
I think it's fair to say it has slipped anyway. So Mr. Thompson from E.ON is nodding, who's closely involved. So I think it has slipped anyway, but when I was preparing yesterday, I thought we had at some point referred to September, in which case that would have been us indicating that it had slipped.
Okay, that's fine. And then, so if the decision is taken on 25th of September, that presumably means that the Statement of Common Grounds with Natural England won't be completed until after that, which will either be deadline 4, which is the 28th of September, or deadline 5, the 13th of November. And similarly, related to that question, if your decision is taken on 25th of September, will you be confirming details at deadline 4, or will there be certain elements that need tidying up and coordinating so that it's a deadline 5 confirmation?
We've been debating that amongst the team, sir, as to what the most efficient way to do things was, obviously guided by you, and we can't, as it resist looking ahead to the rest of the examination and how things are coming together in the sense that there are, from our perspective, quite a small number now of final sort of loose ends or moving parts. We could, so there would seem to be two main approaches. One is to still work within the deadline framework as it's currently set out and put in as much as we can at deadline 4 if it's sensibly available then, and then to put in the rest for deadline 5. In practice, we obviously that date is slightly awkward. If it had been either a bit earlier or a bit later, it would have perhaps produced a more natural outcome. And so the alternative approach would be for us to sort of package everything together so that it all comes in one package that would likely be between deadline 4 and 5. We wouldn't want to artificially wait for deadline 5 to put things in if they're ready before then. Mm. And appreciating that procedural matters are obviously entirely for you, sir, but conceivably you might want to contemplate, it just might be the case, we're speculating that it just might be the case that you were taking a view on the examination in the round such that at that point, and subject to the draft DCO position, that you might be issuing potentially a Rule 17 letter that said, here's the final package. It's got the habitats matrices, it's got the final version of the DCO that the applicant's looking for, it's got the Statement of Common Ground with Natural England, hopefully, which is something I'm sure we'll come on to, it's also got the Statement of Common Ground with Kent County Council, which we think is there, bar two small points that we just need to get somebody to agree. It's not that there's an inherent problem, such that at that point you would be able, once you had given everybody the opportunity to respond to that package, potentially you would feel able to close the examination. So we're obviously happy to work within the deadline framework because that's the default position, but we just wanted to float that other scenario. We're not expecting you to respond or obviously make a decision on that today.
Okay, that's helpful. I will give some thought to that, and I think it's unlikely I'll respond today, but certainly give thought to it. And then the other issue about expressing the heights as AOD, I think that makes a lot of sense. Would it be possible then to express the heights of the existing stacks within the site, the wider sites, as AOD for comparison?
That will depend on how wide-ranging the up-to-date topographical survey was.
Yes.
I think it may make sense for us to discuss that within the team and come back to you after the break, if that's okay.
That's absolutely fine. My thinking on that was, it clearly, if the information is there, it makes it helpful. I'm not wanting you to go out and do further topographical surveys just to provide that information, but clearly, with the new stacks which are up for K3, presumably that information may be there anyway, but I'll leave that to you to consider.
Yes, we do. I've just been informed that we would be able to make a comparison with the K3 stack if that would assist in terms of what's the paper trail that's sort of on the record at the moment. It doesn't particularly feature K3, which would have been predicted at that point rather than as built. I don't think someone will correct me if I get it wrong, but I think there's no reason why the photomontages that are in the ES would need to change in any way as a result of it's been there or thereabouts what's been implicit in the ES anyway.
Yes, understood. Thank you. Good. Can we then move on to question 2.3, please?
We think we've done that, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Applied the track change.
Having further reviewed that myself, I see that the document's fairly short anyway. And I suspect I've picked up most of what the changes were, but I think as a general principle that she'll come on to have track change versions is helpful. Good, thank you. 2.4.
That's simply a typographical mistake, sir.
Okay. So will that be corrected, or...?
I don't...
Well, perhaps not corrected in revising the whole document, but you'll cover that in your post-submission.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
So moving on to 2.5. So this was a question primarily for Natural England, and Natural England have responded to say that it agrees it was premature to say that we agreed with the conclusions of the in-combination assessment before the further information requested on air quality and noise has been provided. It would have been better to state that we agreed the scope of the assessment, but the conclusions need to be checked in the light of further information on air quality and noise. Does the applicant wish to respond on that at all? No?
No, simply that we think that's a fair way of putting it.
Thank you. Question 2.6. Again, it's an issue for clarity rather than anything else. Are you able to provide that clarity in this case for the three plans, please?
Yes. I think the information is elsewhere in the sort of suite of documents, but I'm very happy to add that so that it's conveniently there as well.
Thank you. So moving on to air quality, as I said, we'll deal with 2.7, the end of the item. 2.8 is related to that, but we can probably address that now because it was another question to Natural England. Their response being, the applicant has not yet provided the information requested regarding air quality impacts on Ramsar habitats. We understand from the applicant that this is because the stack height has not been finalised. Natural England has agreed with the applicant that this information will be submitted with the further revisions of the Habitat Regulations Assessment Report. So that effectively confirms what you were saying earlier, Mr. Boswell.
Yes.
Just thinking that through, so the revised Habitat Report, HRA report, was due at deadline 3. Is that now going to slip and be caught in this whole issue of the stack heights? So that's for further consideration. I'm not going to get to deadline 3, that's for sure.
That is right. And deadline 4 might be possible, but looks challenging in the sense that it would mean to hit deadline 4 would mean that Natural England were, in terms of their workload on other matters, were able to prioritise resolving that in the couple of days between those, the boiler decision. And so whilst that might happen, it's perhaps unwise to assume that it will happen.
Okay, that's helpful, thank you. So effectively that is the answer, or part of the answer to question 2.9 then, the first part of that.
Yes, it is.
And then the second part, in fact, effectively, it's a presentational one, isn't it?
I think that will all come out in the wash, in the final version that is agreed.
Yes, So question 210, this was directed at Natural England, and they have responded, we understand from the applicants that an MCZ screening assessment has been carried out, though we have not yet seen it. We have agreed with the applicant that this will be submitted at the same time as the HRAR. So again, the timing for that, do you wish to comment?
Well, I think we agree with what you've just read out, sir, and the expectation is that there isn't any difference between us, and that will also be something that's tidied up in the Statement of Common Ground at the same time.
Thank you. So moving on to 11. Mr. Boswell?
Simply to say that we will reflect that in the final document.
Thank you. So moving on to 212 and 213, which I think appropriate to take together. The reference I've put in there to Rep 1004 is the wrong one. Should be Rep 2030, both cases. So this relates to decommissioning. So the applicant's response states that decommissioning of K4 would make it inoperable, but the applicant is not currently seeking consent to demolish the facility. And there appears to be a discrepancy with the statement in paragraph 10.7 of the ES, which addresses the effects of the decommissioning of K4 on ecology, noting that it is likely that this will involve the removal of plants and demolition of buildings. And I think... and then moving on to 12, decommissioning is identified as a key activity in paragraph 2.4 of the Habitats report. Can the applicant please clarify or expand on its response to Q1.4.31, demonstrating how decommissioning of both K1 and K4 has been addressed in the Habitats report? I think in answering those questions as well, could you have in mind these other points, please, which are what would be the environmental consequences of leaving the plant inoperable on both ecology and other environmental effects, and what are effectively what are the consequences if the plant is to remain? At the moment, there's the indication that decommissioning has been addressed, but no indication of what happens after that. And what I want to understand is what the consequences would be. And effectively, has that retention, potential retention after decommissioning, been addressed in the environmental statement? And what commitment can you give me that demolition of K1 and K4 will take place? So there's a whole range of issues here, which, Mr. Boswell, you may need to bring in a number of your team to answer those, but I think this is one of the areas where, having reviewed the previous answers to some of these questions I've raised before, I still need further clarification or convincing that this matter has been dealt with thoroughly. There still seems to be a few matters which are open-ended at this point.
Okay, so just to deal directly with the issues in these two linked questions, there is a mistake here in that the ES should have been written and the HRA report should have been written entirely consistently on the basis that we were not proposing, and we aren't proposing, decommissioning in perhaps what might be called the normal sense, because I think people do tend to imagine that you're removing the buildings when you say that, and we have very carefully and specifically defined in the DCO and in our approach to the entire project that we aren't doing that. We are simply rendering. We've used the term decommissioning to certainly in relation to the strict DCO drafting to simply mean that the existing facility is rendered inoperable. That then obviously begs the question, which I know we've debated at a previous hearing, as to what is DS Smith's position as to the future, you know, potential demolition of those buildings. And the what we debated on a previous occasion remains the case, that that it's the company, it's the applicant's position that that is for another day. This is, as you know from your site visit, this is a huge complex with a, you know, very clear long-term defined boundary, security perimeter, etc., etc. It's evolved over many decades, and there is, unless there were a clear imperative to do so, which we certainly say there isn't a reason why, particularly with the complexities of this scheme and the fact that some of the elements are being reused as part of the new scheme and so on and so forth, and the fact that the removal of those buildings is quite an undertaking in its own right, which, as and when that happens, would have to be, you know, looked at as an exercise, and the consenting position in relation to that considered at that time, that we don't regard leaving those buildings in place as being as giving rise to significant effects. It's yes, what we're putting in is obviously additional to that, but the fact that those buildings and structures are not being used gives rise to a broadly benign situation. If I'm honest, I would need to double check how much we've actually expressly addressed that in the ES. But as you know, sir, the whole purpose of an ES is to focus on likely significant effects, and I don't think leaving those buildings in any relevant topic area could be said to give rise to a likely significant effect. I'll ask, because you particularly mentioned ecology, I'll ask Mr. Dr. Betson to come in a moment on that point. And we can happily put in a submission, probably a relatively short submission, to give you comfort in our, hopefully in our post-hearing submission, as to why we think you should be comfortable that the ES has addressed that in the way that it has. But I think it fundamentally flows from the points that I've already made, so I won't repeat them. I'm just asking myself if there's any element of your question that I haven't addressed. I think the only other point would be that in the context of this site, I'm not sure it would be appropriate to attempt to impose a demolition obligation onto us. In the planning system, it's very much by exception that there are, you know, obligations that actually require demolition, because that then begs the question, is the funding available to do it? And so two worlds that I am familiar with are the offshore wind farm world and the nuclear world, and in both of those instances there are very specific legislative provisions that require decommissioning programs and also funding programs with teeth to back that up, and this kind of facility doesn't warrant that, and that system doesn't exist in that way. So okay. Unless you want to come back now, I'll
if I can just come back on that, the concept of a demolition obligation. Taking a step back, with decommissioning, there are two elements. One is K1, one is K4. Now, K1, making the plant inoperable. The plant is still part of a major complex which is expanding at the moment, which could be considered to be quite separate from the concept of K4 reaching the end of its life and becoming redundant within the context of, well, 25 years' time, what is happening to the rest of the plant. And I suppose I'm coming at this also from other energy projects where the issues of decommissioning have been dealt with more specifically in requirements, which is something we perhaps come on to tomorrow. I know we've already addressed that to some extent, but it's what happens. Well, firstly, has the impact or the effects of decommissioning been appropriately addressed in the ES for all of those effects? And secondly, what happens if the site becomes redundant, when it becomes redundant, the end of, or that element, the K4 element, becomes redundant? So it's those things that I'm looking for further guidance on, not necessarily now, but I think if they could be looked at further.
I'll just say a couple of things, if I may.
Yes,
so I guess I would couldn't stress strongly enough that that we haven't included demolition, if we sort of cut to the chase and use that word. We haven't included demolition in our DCO application, and that was a very conscious decision, and therefore you do not have in front of you the necessary material to consent that, and that's putting aside any niceties of permitted development rights and all the rest of it, because again, as an aside, I'm involved in a couple of big redevelopment projects of power stations, and that there is, it's not actually uncommon to be able to demolish a power station without consent. If you can get it, if the EIA screened out, you then don't need a planning permission. So I just want to stress that it would be extremely serious for this project if there was, you know, if you were taking the position, which I hope you're not, but I don't know for sure, that somehow this application is defective because it doesn't include demolition. We certainly don't think it is defective. We're saying that's for another day, and the consenting of that will need to be addressed on that occasion. So it would be very serious for this project, very serious for the mill, if this project was in any way caught up in a difficulty on this point. And we don't think there is any reason why that should be the case. There is, on the broader question of demolition, again using that word, we think there is, to an important degree, a sort of horses for courses element in that, and again, I agree we're going to discuss this tomorrow, and it may make sense because it will give us perhaps more of an opportunity within the team to discuss some points. So I appreciate that the main purpose of a DCO hearing is the kind of wording of the DCO rather than the kind of concepts that sit behind it. That the there is a conceptual question of to what extent should there be provision for a power station and I guess other projects to have some kind of decommissioning provisions in there, or demolition provisions. But they tend to be around how you do it, not whether you do it, is my reading of those conditions. Because if you ask, well, what's the enforcement mechanism? You can only impose things that have are effectively credible in enforcement terms, and so I think that is one of the reasons why they tend to be framed in that way, unless they've got the wider legislative basis that I mentioned in passing for those other types of development. So those are my headline points, and we can debate perhaps the decommissioning provisions in the DCO tomorrow. Could I just have a moment to
absolutely, that's fine.
Discuss
yes.
another point with a colleague? So I think it may assist to just give you a preview of what we would expect to be saying on this question of what are the implications of leaving it there and not demolishing it now. So I'm going to ask Tim Spicer on my left of DHA. He is the person that's been coordinating the ES. So whilst he's not a topic specialist in any of the particular topics, he is a specialist on how you pull the S's together, and he has, I know from working with him, that he has a lot of sort of knowledge in each of the different topic areas, so he's the best person to just briefly canter through the different topics and what we will likely be saying on those.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Good morning, sir. It's Tim Spicer of DHA here. I just thought it might be useful. I think you mentioned about what the effects of rendering it inoperable be rather than demolition. I just thought it might be useful just to sort of run through the chapters, just to give you a very sort of headline view on that. I think, you know, if we're talking about effects from rendering it inoperable, if you run through the topic chapters, let's say you take traffic and transport as the first one, if you've got a plant sat there that's inoperable, i.e. there's no one working there and there's nothing going on with it, then there are essentially no traffic movements associated with it. So I think you'd quite readily be able to say transport is removed. The same in the same way as air quality. If it's inoperable, it's not burning gas, it's not emitting emissions from the stack, so there is no air quality impact from it sat there inoperable. And likewise, I'm sure Dr. Nick Betson will pick that up as well, but if you're not emitting the gases, you're then also not affecting deposition on the European sites, because you're not emitting gases from the stack. I think climate change is a similar point in that sense, i.e. the plant's not operating, so you're not burning gas, so there is no contribution to climate change on that basis. I just touch quickly on ground conditions. Obviously, ground conditions are dealt with at the construction stage, and then you've got a plant that's sat there, which is then not affecting ground conditions, so there would be no effect on ground conditions. Likewise, for the water environment and flood risk, you've got an impermeable surface there, and an impermeable surface would remain. With a mechanism to deal with the surface water runoff, obviously in place for the wider paper mill. And then obviously two key topics that we're looking at are heritage and landscape. Now, if you look at those chapters in particular, they have assessed the combination of those plants existing together, and so those effects would remain together. In terms of them being left there, then that is the effect, and then in the event of any future demolition of them, they'd obviously be a beneficial effect rather than an adverse effect. But in terms of leaving there inoperable, the effect of, you know, K1 and K4 coexisting is assessed and concluded. And just touching on archaeology, obviously the archaeology will have been dealt with at the construction phase. So in terms of the plant sat there inoperable, even in the very unlikely event that you'd have K1 and K4 both sat there inoperable, you know, if you're applying the test of the EIA regs on likely significant effects, I think you'd quite readily be justifying that there are no likely significant effects from the plants being sat there inoperable.
I can see that, and that's been very helpful to point out those effects. And I suppose getting into hypotheticals here to some degree, but you would still be left with a plant which would need to be dealt with at some point. Mm-hmm. So within the context of the ES, everything you've said, I've no doubt, is correct, but you still have a plant that's redundant. Mm. So I think we're not going to crack this morning. I need to think it through myself as well, and maybe come back
on that. But understood, yeah.
I think if the team could think about that again, yeah. So that we deal with that whole issue of the your proposal to decommission, which means making it inoperable, how that affects both the ES and the bigger picture, that would be helpful. So I think we'll leave that point for now. Happy to do that.
So there's just one other dimension, Julian Boswell, for the applicant, that it might be worth mentioning in passing, namely that there is an environmental permit here, and when you close a site like this and you surrender a permit, there is a regime there in which you wouldn't be made to demolish everything, but you would be made to render everything safe. There's also a big aspect to that regime to do with land contamination. So we may just mention that in passing as well, because that may give you some comfort that whilst it's not, as I say, requiring full-blown demolition, it does require the site to be left in, I'm not using this as a term of art, you know, in a safe condition. And I've been involved in a few of those as well.
Thank you. Okay, I think unless anyone else wishes to say anything further on that, those two questions, I'm happy to move on. So then, 2.14, that's another response from Natural England. They've confirmed that will confirm the features for the deadline requested. What's actually said there, though, this should be done for deadline 4 to respond to the applicant's revised HRAR and matrices submitted deadline 3. Clearly that's going to slip now, or likely to slip. So the important thing is that any have got it on their checklist and we'll deal with it. So that's fine. 2.15, the response to Q1 439.
That we agree that's a typographical error.
Okay. 2.16.
We're resubmitting the Kemp or the SEMP for deadline 3, and that combined with where we end up on the habitats matrices and the statement of common ground will tie all of that together, sir.
Thank you. 2.17. Effectively, I'm asking you here to assist in getting response from Historic England. Is that something that could be pushed?
I'm going to ask Mr. Spicer to comment on this.
Yes, Tim Spicer, DHA, on behalf of the applicant. I think on this one, just to give a bit of steer on this one, the Historic England obviously responded on the Section 42 draft ES on the 7th of February. In terms of visual impact, which I think you're alluding to with reference to the AOVIA, they confirmed that in terms of visual impact, they were comfortable with the conclusions of the Section 42. We'll just also clarify that there is no conclusions with regard to the scheduled monument or cultural heritage in the LVIA, other than from a general landscape perspective. While you're correct in that, obviously, Historic England haven't responded since the 7th of February for the Section 42 ES, I suppose the position we're taking is that, bearing in mind they've been subject to consultation on the final ES and all the documents that, and their previous involvement, that perhaps their silence is them confirming that they don't have any concern.
Okay. I don't think this is a major issue, but if you can get anything out of them in writing, that would assist. If not, we have the position as you stated. Thank you. So, question 2.18.
I'm going to ask Mr. Spicer to pick up this one as well.
Yes, let me just refer back to the original question so I've got that to hand. Yes, I suppose what I'm looking for here really is a bit more explanation of the different terms that are used and a bit more background, please.
Yes, Tim Spicer, DHA for the applicant. Yes, that's fine. I can give you a bit more clarity. Obviously, I'm not the noise specialist, but I can certainly answer this question. So just for a bit of background, the LAEQ is basically let's describe it as an average over a given time period, an average noise level. LA max, as it sort of self-explains, is the maximum noise level. Now, for construction noise, you get because of the nature of it, it's not a regular constant noise, it's banging, it's, you know, it's varying in nature, you get a relatively greater difference between the LA EQ and the LA Max. That contrasts to some extent with the sort of operation of the CHP, which is more a constant hum or noise to that effect. So in that extent, the LA EQ and the LA Max are basically pretty much numerically identical, or certainly very similar. But just to provide absolute clarity on that, if, for example, you're looking at the operation of the plant, and we looked at the noisiest plant item, which would be the emergency steam release valve, which admittedly would only be sounded in an emergency. But if you look at that as a noisiest plant item, you'd be talking about an LA Max at the nearest ecological receptors, i.e. the swale, of about 70 LA Max. And certainly under operating conditions, you'd be looking at the LA Max much below that for the normal operation of the plant.
What would be the normal LA Max without that, roughly?
I wouldn't want to commit to that exactly because I'm not the noise consultant, but I believe from my conversation with him, yeah, it's around about, yeah, I thought it's certainly less than 60.
That's fine, thank you.
They will give you a written response to that.
That'd be helpful, thank you. Good. If we can then move on to other matters in the table. So 2.19, which I referred to earlier, is about the presentation of documents.
Yes, we're happy to do that, sir.
Thank you. 2.20 concerns the revised National Planning Policy Framework.
Yes, sir. We've looked at that. We don't think there's anything particularly worth drawing to your attention in that respect.
And 2.21 is something for swales, so that's not something we can address this morning. It's effectively a matter of clarification of which parts of documents they are referring to. So the remaining item for the table is question 2.7. Now, I think it's 11:05 now. Perhaps we'll have a short break, 10 minutes, and then come back and deal with that matter and the rest of the agenda. So it shouldn't take too long, but it's probably advisable to have a break. But before we do that, just to explain what I'm looking for in relation to 2.7, I'd like to start with an overview of air quality, the basic principles, so that I fully understand those, looking at then the impacts on ecology. So starting from concepts of the ambient concentration, process contribution, predicted environmental concentration, and then putting that into the context of the Natural England's relevant representation, which clearly addresses the effects on ecology. As we go through that, I'd probably have a number of detailed questions arising, but it's to make sure that I fully understand the concepts and how you've got to those answers. So perhaps we could do that after a short break. So it's now, as I say, it's just after 11:05. If we adjourn until 11:20, come back at that point. Thank you very much.